Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Health Care for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we're going to be focusing on the new Republican bill in Congress known as the American Health Care Act. It's their proposal to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, the law that was put forward and successfully passed by President Obama and the Democratic Congress back in 2010. This week is the 7th anniversary of the signing of the law by President Obama on Thursday, March 23rd. So we'll be taking a look at what the Republicans have got in mind, and surprisingly, it also is going to affect Medicaid in a very significant way that hadn't been expected. So we'll be getting an update on all of that, both what's in the law, or the bill, I guess I should say, it's not law yet, and how New Yorkers are responding here in New York City. So stay tuned for that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action news for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. Advertising experts say that the aim of all direct-to-consumer advertising for prescription drugs is getting patients or their family members to remember a particular drug's name and to ask for the name by prescription when they see their doctors. Spending on such commercials has grown 62% since 2012, even as ad spending for most other products was flat. However, the proliferation of drug advertisements has generated new controversy, in part because the ads inevitably promote high-priced drugs, some of which doctors say have limited practical utility for the average patient viewer. The cost of Lyrica, a drug for diabetic pain, is about $400 for 60 capsules, for example. Critics say the ads encourage patients to ask their doctors for expensive, often marginal, and sometimes inappropriate drugs that are fueling spiraling healthcare spending. The American Medical Association took a hardline position on these ads 2 years ago in 2015 by calling for an outright ban on them. Such a prohibition is unlikely, however. Previous efforts to push such an outcome have stalled, generally on free speech arguments by the powerful drug lobby and assertions that such ads do provide valuable information to patients about treatment options. One thing is certain, direct-to-consumer advertising is big, and as nearly everyone who watches TV knows, it's getting bigger. Some programs, such as the nightly news and sitcoms, aimed at older Americans get most of their advertising from drug companies. A Kantar analysis shows 72% of commercial breaks on the CBS Evening News have at least one pharmaceutical advertisement. Commonly, the ads target a range of conditions that generally affect this older demographic, such as dry eyes, erectile dysfunction, pain, and constipation. 62% of commercials breaks during the soap opera General Hospitals also include a drug advertisement of some sort. Drug makers were on track to spend an estimated $6.4 billion on direct-to-consumer advertising in the U.S. last year, up 5% from the previous year, according to Kantar. In 2012, spending for pharmaceutical television ads was the 12th largest category. However, by last year, drug ads were the 6th largest. While substantial, the spending was less than the amount spent by automakers, retail stores, and restaurants. Major broadcast networks such as ABC, CBS, NBC, along with cable channels like CNN, draw a lot of the pharmaceutical advertising. According to the firm Swallen, the effect of the ban on networks would be daunting, of a potential ban on networks would be daunting, 8% loss of total ad revenue. And its impact would be most evident for programming popular with viewers older than age 60, for example, evening news shows. Similarly, cable networks such as the Hallmark Channel, which draw viewers from this demographic, would feel the pinch because they have more skin in the game. Preet Bharara, the former top federal prosecutor in Manhattan recently fired by the Trump administration, was investigating the stock trades by Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price prior to his ouster last week, ProPublica reported earlier last week. The report attributed to an unnamed person familiar with the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Southern District of New York, revived questions about the propriety of Secretary Price's investments in numerous healthcare companies that stood to benefit from legislation he voted for and sponsored when he was a Georgia congressman. Those concerns have dogged the former congressman, now secretary, since Trump nominated and he's taken office to head the Department of Health and Human Services. It also brought fresh dramatic flair to the little that is known about how one of the nation's most prominent U.S. attorneys lost his job. Bharara, whose jurisdiction included Wall Street, gained fame prosecuting federal corruption cases over 8 years on the job. The U.S. Attorney's Office declined to comment on ProPublica's report. Secretary Price, previously a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, came under fire during his confirmation hearings earlier this year for his health industry and stock trades and promised to divest himself of holdings within 90 days of taking office. A department spokesperson said last week that Price had met the requirement but declined to release details. Among Secretary Price's stock purchases that garnered the most security, his investment in a firm known as Innate Immunotherapeutics. While Secretary Price sat on the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee, he brought shares of this Australian biotech firm in a private placement at a discounted rate of 18 cents per share. The new private placement announced last week will offer shares at 72 cents per share. Innate's trading on the Australian Stock Exchange was suspended while the company raises capital. Innate has deep connections to Trump administration confident representative Chris Collins, a Republican from upstate western New York who sits on the Health Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Representative Collins owns 17% of the company's shares, making him its largest shareholder. One of the company's pending FDA applications is happening right outside Collins' district. Collins also served on Trump's transition team, heading up initiatives around health, including Price's nomination itself. And finally, an estimated $5.8 billion in cuts to the National Institutes of Health and President Trump's proposed budget put out last week has many top universities and medical institutions sounding the alarm. Trump's spending plan, running into opposition from Republicans and Democrats alike, would cut about 20% of roughly $30 billion budget of the nation's medical research agency that supports research on cancer, Alzheimer's disease, Zika, and many other medical conditions. Research institutions nationwide have decried the cuts as potentially devastating to their work. Based in Bethesda, Maryland, the National Institutes of Health spends most of its annual budget, about 85%, on grants to thousands of researchers and medical institutions across the country. Traditionally, biomedical research has enjoyed strong bipartisan support, surviving ideological-driven cutbacks from one administration to the next. Grant increases to major NIH recipients had been averaging about 3% per year during the Obama administration. NIH officials declined to comment on Trump's budget blueprint, but its parent agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, released a statement saying the agency is dedicated to fulfilling our department's mission to improve health and well-being of the American people, close quote. The official said the budget supports that mission and will help ensure the delivery of critical services in the most efficient and effective manner possible. Congressional Democrats are already pushing back hard on Trump's fiscal plan, as are some Republicans. Political observers caution that the president's budget proposals, while signaling administration priorities, rarely are approved as is without Congress making major changes. In a press briefing last week, Mick Mulvaney, the director of Trump's administration's Office of Management and Budget, supported a major reorganization of the NIH, calling for a consolidation of the agency's 27 different institutes and centers with a focus on efficiencies. According to Mulvaney, the agency had been subject to mission creep, expanding beyond their core functions. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment in a moment, taking a look at what's in the new Republican health care bill known as the American Health Care Act. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment today, we're going to be taking a look at the new American Health Care Act, the new bill put forward in Congress by the Republican majority in the House. They're taking it supposedly to a floor debate and vote this week. Joining us to understand all of that is Amanda Dunker, who's a policy associate with the Community Service Society of New York, Bridget Walsh, who's Senior Policy Analyst for Health and Public Health with the Schuyler Center for Analysis and Advocacy, and Lois Utley, Director of Raising Women's Voices New York. Welcome back, all three, to Health Action.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Lois. Okay. Amanda, let me start with you. This is supposedly the Republicans' Affordable Care Act repeal and replace bill. Before we get into the particulars of the bill itself, how has New York fared under the Affordable Care Act so far?
Well, New York, like most states, has done really well under the Affordable Care Act. Nationally, one thing that ACA did was create these marketplaces where people could buy insurance, and then you got premium subsidies and tax credits to help you afford it. Nationally, about 13 million people bought those plans. I think in New York State, it's about 400,000 people, and most of those people got the premium assistance. Another 10 million people were able to get onto Medicaid because the ACA expanded Medicaid to childless adults. Prior to that, New York had some options for childless adults, but the ACA expanded the number of people who are eligible for that coverage. So in New York, that was about maybe a million people who were able to get Medicaid for the first time. And the other thing that ACA did was create something called the Basic Health Plan in the ACA in New York State. It's called the Essential Plan, and that is for people who make a little bit too much money to be eligible for Medicaid. So you get a very low-cost health insurance option that's not available in most other states. And in New York State, that's about 700,000 people.
Great. So that gives us sort of a little bit of the lay of land. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act did much more than just stuff around insurance coverage, although that has gotten justifiably a lot of the media attention over the years, and it was one of the major purposes of the bill. So what does the new American Health Act say about the coverage provisions under the Affordable Care Act?
So it does leave some of the coverage provisions in place. What this bill mainly does is it messes around with some of the spending and revenue-raising portions of the ACA. So some of the things that I didn't mention just now, like the expanding the pre-existing condition protection so that an insurance company has to sell you a plan no matter what your previous health experiences were, that stuff all stays in place with the bill. But the way that that stuff is paid for changes a lot. So one thing that the ACA did to help insurance companies manage this extra cost, you know, of covering people with pre-existing conditions was the individual mandate. So you had to buy insurance or you would get a penalty. That's kind of gone away already because the IRS said they're not going to enforce it, but the American Healthcare Act gets rid of it in statute as well. So that removes some of the assistance that we were giving to insurance companies to cover those people who are more expensive to cover. It also, you know, another thing we did was the premium subsidies that helped people afford insurance. That is changing a lot. So instead of it being based on your income, where you get more help if you have less money, it's based only on your age. So a lot of people are going to get less assistance. People who have more money are going to get more help. But people who have less money are not going to get as much help as they used to get under the ACA. And so a lot of those people might get priced out of the market. An additional thing that the new bill does is it allows older people to get charged up to 5 times more than younger people. So those people will get more help, like I said, because the premium assistance is now based on your age. But they can only get twice as much help, and the limit is about $4,000 a year. So we think a lot of those older people will also get priced out of the market.
Bridget, bringing you into the conversation now, just the basics. What does the new Republican American Healthcare Act do in terms of impact on the Medicaid program? Well, maybe before we get into that, let's just do a little Medicaid 101. So for people who may not be familiar, what is the Medicaid program?
Okay, thanks, Mark. So the Medicaid program serves low-income populations, including children, parents, pregnant women, the elderly, and children and adults with disabilities. And for many, it provides a real lifeline for people who live in poverty with health needs that can't afford private insurance, or they have health needs that go beyond the benefits that a lot of private insurance would afford. I think a lot of times people confuse Medicare and Medicaid. Just so quickly, the Medicare serves the elderly and people with disabilities who receive Social Security regardless of income, where Medicaid is a joint federal and state program, and each state establishes its own standards for eligibility, for benefits, and provider payment rates, but those are under broad federal guidelines that set a minimum standard. So where Medicare is a federal program and the federal government sets the standards, Medicaid, the costs are shared with the federal and state government. So currently in New York, we have over 6 million people covered by Medicaid. And right now, Medicaid is an entitlement. If you meet the eligibility criteria, you can enroll and get the services. Regardless of how many people New York enrolls, it gets matching dollars from the federal government. So New York gets a matching rate of 50%. So for every $100 that New York spends, it receives another $100 from the federal government. And because of this arrangement, the risk is shared between the states and the federal government. The Affordable Care Act also gave states the option to expand Medicaid to non-disabled adults under 65 with incomes that are at or below 138% of the federal poverty level, which was about $15,500 or something in that area for an individual. States decided that wanted to do the expansion received an enhanced rate for this population of 100% for a few years, and then it would drop down to 90. So New York took this option and added additional people to the program at this enhanced match. So the two things, significant things, that the House legislation does is it fundamentally changes this financing equation. First, it imposes a per capita cap. So it takes all the people we have enrolled in Medicaid and divides them up into categories: elderly, persons with disability, children, the newly eligible adults and then other adults. And then what it does is it looks at how much the state pays on average to cover people in those groups. So how much are we paying to cover people in, who are elderly, or how much are we paying to cover children? Then it totals up the number of people in each of those groups and multiplies it by that average. And then it applies a trend factor for inflation moving forward. So what it does is that amount is all the state is going to get for a targeted year, regardless of how many people are enrolled in the program or the total cost of the program. Second piece that it does is it eliminates that enhanced match for the expansion population. Those already in the category get to keep the enhanced match unless they break their enrollment. When they come back in, they don't come in at the enhanced rate. And, you know, so this is a fundamental restructuring of the way that this we've been financing health policy in a lot of ways for decades. And it's really hard to imagine a more fundamental or disruptive change to the Medicaid program, which has really been a lifeline for children, for families, persons with disability, and the elderly for over 50 years.
And Lois, the other thing that the American Health Care Act affects is access to women's health services, particularly reproductive health care. What does it propose to do?
Well, there's two provisions that especially would be problematic for women. The first is an ideological attack on Planned Parenthood because some Planned Parenthoods provide abortion services. So under this bill, women would be unable to use any federally funded insurance to obtain any services at Planned Parenthood. So, for example, a woman cannot get tests for cervical cancer or even prenatal care at a Planned Parenthood if she's using Medicaid insurance or, for example, TRICARE, which is the military insurance. The rationale behind this policy is essentially to punish Planned Parenthood for providing abortion services. What's not commonly recognized, though, is that use of federal funding for abortion services is already sharply restricted. It can only be used in cases of rape, incest, or to save the life of the woman. This policy would forbid use of Medicaid not only for these three types of abortions, but for anything else, contraception, breast exams, STD testing, and so on. And I wanted to note that the defunding of Planned Parenthood would also hurt LGBT people, since a number of Planned Parenthood clinics now serve that community, including providing hormones for people undergoing gender transition. So that's the Planned Parenthood issue. A second issue I'd like to highlight is the continuing assault on the ability of women to use our own money to buy private insurance that covers abortion. So already under the Affordable Care Act, a woman cannot use federal premium subsidy dollars to pay for a health plan that includes abortion. Instead, a woman must pay at least a dollar a month of her own money for this policy, and it goes into a segregated fund to pay for the abortion part of the health policy. This new Republican bill goes one step further and says a woman cannot buy such a policy at all if any part of the premium is paid for with the federal premium tax credits. So we really worry that the consequence is going to be that insurers will just drop abortion coverage rather than risk losing business from women who would want to buy it using these premium tax credits. Interesting, I was just reading an article on Politico that there are concerns that this abortion restriction might not be ruled germane. And when the Senate takes up this bill, there are what called Byrd rules after Senator Byrd that allow only certain types of provisions and things that are being pushed through in a reconciliation bill. So maybe that will drop out, but we are quite concerned about it.
So let's then circle back around and talk for a minute about what does all of this potentially mean for everyday New Yorkers. So Amanda, these changes that are being proposed under the Republican law to the Affordable Care Act, what would it mean for everyday people?
Part of it depends on your age and your income, of course. So as far as the premium, the changes to the premium assistance, like I said before, like we think that a lot of older people are probably going to get priced out of the market because the way that the premiums will work, and this is an example from the Congressional Budget Office that we found pretty shocking. So if you're a 64-year-old person, so you can't have Medicare yet, and you make about $18,000 a year, which is 175% of the federal poverty level, you're going to be asked to pay $14,600 for health insurance, including the new premium assistance you get, which is not going to be based on your income anymore, right? So that's over half of somebody's income. That person is just not going to buy insurance. So we think there will be a lot of people in their 50s and 60s who end up in that position where they make, you know, supposedly are too wealthy for Medicaid, but the assistance that they can get, that $4,000 premium tax credit, is just so inadequate to buy health insurance that they're just not going to be able to do it. For younger people, there won't be that much change. You know, CBO's example, a 21-year-old in both, you know, under the ACA and under the new law would only end up paying about $1,400 for insurance. So, you know, for them, it's not a huge change other than, you know, losing some of the consumer protections that are part of the ACA. But we're a little bit worried that, like, those older people who aren't buying insurance, a lot of those costs are going to build up while they don't have insurance and aren't getting care. And that's going to make the Medicare program less sustainable.
And Bridget, for New Yorkers who are on the Medicaid program or might qualify for it, what would be the impact of them should this new bill become law?
Well, you know, Mark, there's been a lot of talk from folks at the federal level saying that the changes in financing to Medicaid will be okay because states will get more flexibility. But the truth is New York and states already have a great deal of flexibility within their programs, and they we can apply for waivers to get more flexibility currently if we want to implement innovative programs. So I think that the important thing is that in the context of the financing and flexibility, what they're really saying is states will have the flexibility to either reduce the number of people on the rolls, reduce the benefits that they cover, or to reduce the payments that we give to providers. So that's really the kind of flexibility we're going to be talking about. So I think that, you know, some of the things that are going to make it more difficult for people who are either on Medicaid or are close to the Medicaid line is that during times where there might be an economic downturn, it's going to be harder to enroll people in Medicaid even if they need health coverage. It undercuts an important tool that New York can use to respond to disasters and public health crises. So, for example, during Hurricane Sandy or the Zika outbreak or even the opioid epidemic, states sometimes need additional funding to cover the cost of those programs and to treat people who are in need. And it also limits the state's options when it comes to thinking about covering new drugs or new treatments. I mean, last year was just the example of the EpiPen cost increases and how those costs had to be absorbed. So the state will no longer have the flexibility that it needs to do that and is going to have to be looking for ways to cut services or the number of people who are eligible.
And Lois, looking at the new Republican bill, what would it mean for women in New York?
Well, in addition to the issues I already mentioned, Planned Parenthood and abortion coverage, women have a tremendous amount at stake with all the other changes we've been discussing. New York women have enthusiastically embraced the Affordable Care Act coverage options that they've been able to get through New York State of Health Marketplace. Women make up 52% of all Medicaid enrollees under age 65. And 54% of the enrollees in that new essential plan that's just above the Medicaid eligibility limit. We're particularly concerned about women in that 50 and 60-year-old category that Amanda was mentioning. This is the time of life when women are often losing dependent health insurance coverage through death of a spouse, through divorce, or through having a slightly older spouse who gets onto Medicare and leaves his wife behind without coverage. So that unaffordable coverage that Amanda was describing would really hurt women in their 50s and early 60s. Of course, Medicaid pays for half of all births now, and that would, you know, cuts there would really hurt women of reproductive health age. And lastly, let's think about elderly women. Medicaid is a prime source of long-term care, and women make up the majority of elderly people needing that care. So the more we see the Medicaid program as a whole squeezed through these various changes the Republicans are proposing, the more danger there is for elderly women.
And anything at risk? You mentioned earlier the LGBT population. Anything in particular at risk for them?
Well, you know, the LGBT community has benefited a lot from the expansion of Medicaid and from the creation of the Essential Plan. For various historic reasons, LGBT people have had higher rates of uninsurance than the general population. You know, some of us have work for employers that don't give health insurance, or some of us have been discriminated against in regular job market and have been self-employed. So we really have depended on the expanded Medicaid and the Essential Plan to really make up for the difference.
So Amanda, we're taping this earlier in the week. It's a little difficult, but how are things looking for some action in Congress this week, perhaps?
Well, they're not looking as good as I think Republicans expected to. I mean, Republicans were hoping that they could, you know, get rid of the ACA 2 months ago. They still haven't done that, of course. This is the first time we've seen anything written down from the Republican side of things, the people who have been saying for years and years, we've got to get rid of the ACA. This is their big, finally, like their big replacement bill. And everybody hates it, basically. Doctors hate it. Hospitals hate it. Consumer groups like CSS and Healthcare for All New York hate it. And a lot of Republicans who are more moderate Republicans are saying, we're really not sure if we can vote for this bill. So I think when I last checked, it was, I think we need like 21 Republicans in the House to say no, and then the bill would be stopped in the House. And I think there's at least 27 Republicans who have said, we're really not sure about this bill. A lot of them are in New York State. So it doesn't have great chances. It's nothing certain. So I think a lot of people, you know, House members need to hear from their constituents who are worried about the bill and hear from the people who voted for them that it's not a good idea to vote for this bill. But if people do that, if they keep the pressure up, I think there's a good chance that it won't pass.
And Bridget, you talked a bit about Medicaid vis-a-vis everyday people. We've talked a bit about that. But what about the state's healthcare system? It's a very important program, correct?
It is a very important program. And as Amanda just said, a lot of the members of the healthcare community have opposed this legislation. You know, in New York, hospitals have opposed it. Places, rural areas have opposed it because of the cuts that they're planning to see to really essential providers at that level. The community health centers have opposed it. I know at the national level, the American Academy of Physicians, the AMA, the American Academy of Pediatricians, have all opposed this. So there is a wide range of folks in the health community that have opposed this. The other thing I think it's important to remember, Mark, is we see cuts to federal reimbursement coming in for health programs. It's going to put a lot of pressure on other parts of the state budget to make up for that loss of health dollars. So other types of programs that folks rely on might also wind up being squeezed as dollars need to be diverted. So I think that's another part that people really need to take stock of is where would the state come up with the funding for health programs if the federal government does cap the amount coming in for Medicaid.
And you're based upstate in the Albany region. What's kind of the buzz up there in the upstate region? How are the members of Congress looking at this?
Well, I think there's been a lot of reticence to talk publicly at this point about what their positions are. I think there's been a lot of pressure on the upstate members of the Republican House to really understand the impact that this is going to have on their constituents and also on the state and the state budget. So I think that advocates have been really trying to drive out turnout at meetings, letters, phone calls, to really put pressure on members in those Republican districts to understand what the devastating impact that this would have for their constituents.
And Lois, what are women's advocates saying and doing across the state here?
Well, as you've heard and what I've said previously, women are very much at risk in this proposal to repeal and replace the ACA. So many women's groups are actively advocating on behalf of Planned Parenthood. There have been many, many rallies and other types of actions, particularly here in the city, to try to save Planned Parenthood of New York City, which is such a major provider of health care for so many women and LGBT people. And nationally, a lot of us are participating in what's called a women's defense table, where we're looking particularly at the threats to women's health care from this ACA repeal, and doing our best to influence Congress and try to point out the harm that would come to women and our families from this bill.
Okay, well, we've been getting a bit of an update here, or actually introduction, because it literally just came out a week or two ago, to the new American Health Care Act. It's the Republican bill to propose to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which is the major health care reform bill that was brought in by the Obama administration and the Democrats back in 2010. Our guests have been Amanda Dunker, Policy Associate with the Community Service Society of New York, Bridget Walsh, Senior Policy Analyst for Health and Public Health with the Schuyler Center for Analysis and Advocacy, and Lois Utley, who's Director of Raising Women's Voices New York. Thanks so much for helping us get a bit of a briefing on this and joining us on Health Action today.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back with our second interview in a moment, taking a look at what's happening here locally in New York City around advocacy efforts for the one Republican member of Congress from New York City. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In the first part of the program, we got an overview of the new Republican bill in Congress to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The bill is known as the American Health Care Act. And in the second part, we're going to be taking a look at how various forces here in New York City have been responding to that proposal. Joining us is Terry Cagliari from Staten Island, who's with Organizing for Action and Staten Island for Change, and Sally McMahon with Fight Back Bay Ridge. Welcome, Terry and Sally, to Health Action.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
So we've all been kind of working together, focusing our time and energy on the one member of the House majority, the Republicans from New York City. His name is Dan Donovan. He represents Staten Island and parts of Southwest Brooklyn. The first thing out of the gate, Terry, was back right pretty soon after the election when you and others helped organize a speak out. Tell us what happened then.
It was a freezing cold day, and I didn't think anybody would show up because it was so, so cold. And yet people just kept coming and kept coming because this was an issue that resonated with so many people. And this was the first time that I heard so many people that were going to be impacted telling their stories, and anybody who would listen to them would have to say, oh my God, we've got to keep this.
And this was outside the offices of Representative Donovan on Staten Island.
Yeah, and again, we've put together this coalition. So there was many groups that were represented there. We had Make the Road, My Group, OFA, CWA, many people.
Right. And then, so that was the first thing. And then the second thing that happened was about a month later, was just prior to the inauguration. Tell us about that event. And you were critical in organizing that, too.
Then we had a candlelight vigil. And this time here, our crowd was so loud, so large that we had to be across the street from his office. They actually put us in a pen so that we wouldn't interfere with traffic. And it was twice as large as the first time. And so it was again, impressive how the crowds were building, how the momentum was gathering, that people realized, like, wait, this could really happen. They really could take away our health care. And so we had candlelight vigil. We sang songs. And again, people told their stories on how important this was to them.
We made some special signs then, too.
Yes, we did. We made some tombstones to show how this impacts people, how many people would literally have their life on the line if the Affordable Care Act was repealed. And because this not only impacts people who are directly getting Obamacare, but it impacts people who are getting Medicaid. It impacts children who are getting CHIP. It impacts so many people down the line. Even if you have your own insurance from your employer, there are many things that now have to be carried and covered. The 10 essential things that you didn't have before. So now you get preventative care. You get birth control. You get all these things that you must have. So it really has expanded health care for everybody, not just people who directly got Obamacare.
Sally, bringing you into the conversation now, we're now moving forward into February. It's the lead up to the congressional break that happened then, when all those town meetings happened around the country. And you guys first did a town hall in the streets. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so Dan Donovan decided he would not do a live town hall. He would do a telephone town hall, which there were pre-screened questions. So you called in, if you got through, you left a question, and then if they chose you, you were the one who got to speak. There was no back and forth, though. There was just Dan's pre-written statement. Many people were dropped off of the telephone list. Many people like myself who have cell phones could not be added to the list. So a bunch of people in Bay Ridge got together, went out to his office during the tele-town hall and held our own sit-in kind of protest town hall, where we held up signs with the questions we wished he would have answered. We engaged with people on the street, and some press turned out as well.
And then just a few days later, literally from that, you guys all organized what turned out to be a quite sizable rally outside his office. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so we wanted to do an action to support the ACA, and we also want Dan Donovan to hold a town hall. And our third purpose was to form alliances with the rest of Community District 11, in particular with our Staten Island neighbors. So we decided to hold a rally focusing on the ACA and the need for a town hall. So we worked together as CD11, and it was sizable. I hear that the police said they thought there were about 300 of us there. We had speakers, we had professional people speak, and we had many people speak from both sides of the bridge who were impacted and need Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, the stories were quite moving there. Do you happen to recall a couple of them? There was this one guy who got up and told a story about surviving, was it cancer, I think, right?
Yes. There was a cancer survivor. There was a woman whose husband has ulcerative colitis, who was practically near death before he got treatment and is now in remission. There was a very young woman who, because of the ACA, was able to be pre-screened for polyps, which are precancerous, which were removed. There was a woman who spoke about her daughter who was premature, born premature, and has many issues that are not covered unless she has ACA. So there were a number of people, like I said, from both sides of the bridge with very compelling stories.
So Terry, now turning back to you, later that same week, this was during the presidential recess back in February, we actually did do a town hall in Staten Island. So what was that like?
Again, the crowds keep growing, and this was a wonderful experience of with people telling their stories. We also had a panel of experts, if you will, to talk about the ACA before people asked their questions. And people asked questions, but mostly they would just really want to tell their stories. I think people really want Dan Donovan and others to know that this is something they need. This is not something that you can just lightly say, oh yeah, well, whatever. This is a necessity. This is what makes their lives livable. Without this, they don't have that chance.
This was held at a community center in the part of the island called Stapleton. Representative Donovan was invited. Did he show up?
No. We had a little chair, though, for him.
And what was? Did he give a reason?
Yes. the climate was not correct. He felt that if he appeared at this kind of a venue, that he would not be accepted, that he would meet hostility.
And this brings us maybe, I don't know if you were at this event, in early February there was a meeting in downtown Brooklyn that the Chamber of Commerce held. Were you there, Sally, for that?
Yes, that was actually what springboarded a number of events because of that. I was at the Chamber of Commerce breakfast. What happened was there was the representatives, the congressional representatives from Brooklyn were all invited to speak, and Donovan is the only Republican one. So people from our neighborhood decided to go and attend and do what was supposed to be a silent protest. So every time that Donovan spoke, we held up signs directed in particular to the Muslim ban, because that was when the first Muslim order came out, and Donovan is pro-Muslim ban. So when he spoke, we stood and we held signs up that either said, you know, no Muslim ban or town hall ban or whatever it was. He used that as an excuse to not meet with any constituents. He's exaggerated the amounts. He said that 40 people were escorted out. There were not even 40 protesters in the meeting. Perhaps two were escorted out. Some people left of their own accord. Most of us stayed for the entire breakfast.
Yeah, I was there. It was interesting. So the end of the recess week in February, then there were two back-to-back events back out in Diker Heights where his office is. Were you at either one of those?
I was not.
Okay, so there was first a general kind of protest calling for a town meeting that community folks had organized, and then there was an event that physicians and medical students organized, where they came and told stories about their patients and what was at risk for their patients. That got a lot. There probably were about 200 or 300 people for that, and I think the previous event, they were literally held the same day back to back, had a slightly bigger crowd from that.
There were a number of people from Fight Back Bay Ridge did attend that rally with the doctors, and they all said that it was really well attended, and the doctors and the people who spoke were excellent.
So taking a look at what's coming up, Terry, literally as this program airs the next day on March 23rd, we're doing something else, calling on Representative Donovan. What's happening at lunchtime?
Yes, we're having a funeral march for Trump Care, burying it. So we're starting at the Newdorp train station, and we're going to proceed with the Grim Reaper, Mark Hannay.
Well, I don't know if it's going to be me, but somebody is going to wear that costume.
And,
we bought it. It looks
right.
Good.
Okay, great. So, yes, we're going to have a Grim Reaper, and we're going to walk in a funeral procession up to his office.
And we're going to leave a coffin there and some other things, signs with him, yeah, tombstone signs. Yep, yep. And then you folks, Sally, I know it's still at very early stages, but you are planning for your own town hall event in during the April recess period when Congress will be back home for the Easter Passover break. Can you clue us a little bit of what you got in mind so far?
Sure. So we're planning on holding an informative town hall for the neighborhood. We would love it if Dan Donovan will attend, and we have two members going down to meet with him in D.C. tomorrow who will extend that invitation to him. We're in the process of trying to secure a space right now. We're shooting for April 17th, 18th, or 19th. We're lining up speakers from healthcare, on immigration, from hopefully to speak about Medicare and Social Security. I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. But when we're lining up, the environment, and we're lining up a number of issues like that for the neighbors to come and ask their questions. We will have a table there. We will have a chair there for Donovan. Hopefully he will sit in it. We'll also have voter registration and leaflets and information available. We also have on Monday the 27th, we're delivering 1,000 cans of chicken soup to his office.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The chicken soup is not healthcare.
Not a healthcare plan, Dan.
Great. And Terry, although this will be airing after your event earlier on Wednesday evening, the 29th. So you have one more event coming up. That's right. I forgot. I'm getting my dates mixed up here.
Yes, on March 29th, we're going to have an Arts Celebrates the Right to Healthcare event. And we have quite an extensive lineup of musicians, video, spoken word, all people that are going to be talking about the right to healthcare.
And that will be when and where?
That will be March 29th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church, 312 Fillmore Street on Staten Island.
And is there a way people can find information online about this? Is there a Facebook event or anything like that?
There is a Facebook event, Staten Island for Change.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you. We've been getting a little bit of literally on-the-ground organizing that's happening here in New York City in response to the new Republican health care bill called the American Health Care Act. It's been activities that have been happening in the 11th Congressional District, which covers all of Staten Island and parts of Southwest Brooklyn. Our guests have been Terry Cagliari with Staten Island for Change and Organizing for Action, and Sally McMahon with Fight Back Bay Ridge. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Terry and Sally.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
And as you plan out your week, we've got some announcements here for you from that have come into the Health Action here at WBAI. Tomorrow, Thursday, March 23rd at 12 noon, there will be a Save Us from Trump Care mock funeral procession. It will be taking place on Staten Island. Folks can gather outside the Newdorp station of the Staten Island Railroad, on the Newdorp Lane end of the station, and folks will be marching to the nearby offices of Representative Dan Donovan. They're located at 265 Newdorp Lane on Staten Island. The Grim Reaper and so forth will be there. Again, that's tomorrow, Thursday, March 23rd at 12 noon. Save Us from Trump Care mock funeral procession. Gather at noon outside the Newdorp Lane exit of the Staten Island Railroad. Also tomorrow evening, a new protest coming up, Whose Side Are You On, Lee? It's a protest outside a fundraiser for Representative Lee Zeldin. He's a Republican who represents the east end of Long Island. He's doing a fundraiser here in Midtown Manhattan. It's being held at the Hunt and Fish Club, located at 125 West 44th Street in Midtown Manhattan. That's between 6th and 7th Avenues. The protest starts at 5:30 and will go on as guests arrive for the event and maybe last on until they leave after 8 p.m. We'll see how long everything people can hang out for. Again, that's tomorrow evening, Thursday, March 23rd. A protest. Whose side are you on, Lee? It's a protest outside a fundraiser for Representative Lee Zeldin. It's being held in Midtown Manhattan outside the Hunt and Fish Club, located at 125 West 44th Street in Manhattan, starting at 5:30. On Saturday, April 1st at 11 a.m. will be a March for Health. It's part of a series of marches happening that day all across the country, marches for health. This New York one will be forming up around 11 a.m. outside Trump Tower, located at 57th Street and 5th Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. And they'll be marching to a rally over at outside the Trump International Hotel on Columbus Circle, which is 59th Street and 8th Avenue, Central Park West. There'll be public officials and so forth. This march is actually being spearheaded and led by a variety of physician organizations, medical students, and other health professionals, and they're inviting everyone to join in that. Again, that is this that'll be Saturday, April 1st, the April Fool's Day. March for Health, forming up at 11 a.m. outside Trump Tower, going over to the rally at the Trump International Hotel at Columbus Circle. And lastly, there'll be a community meeting taking a look at how we push back on all the proposed changes in Congress being made to the Medicaid program. It's organized by the Commission on the Public Health System and their allies. It'll be taking place on Thursday evening, April 6th at 6 p.m., taking place at Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union. They're located at 25 West 18th Street in Manhattan, just west of 5th Avenue. Again, that's a community meeting and mobilization forum on protecting Medicaid on Thursday evening, April 6th, 6 p.m. at 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union, 25 West 18th Street off 5th Avenue in Manhattan. It's organized by the Commission on the Public Health System and their allies and partners. So those are some things that you can get involved with, show up in, participate, have a little bit of fun, raise a little hell, and learn something too. And that'll do it for some announcements for this week's Health Action Program. I'm Mark Hannay. And that'll do it for this week's program. We'll be back next week with Health Action here in our new time slot. We want to welcome everybody, all our new listeners here at this new time. I hope you're enjoying the programs we're presenting so far. Thanks also to Reggie Johnson for engineering today's program. I'm Mark Hannay.
Thursday, March 23rd at 10 p.m., join the Sweet Spot as we host Renaissance Dance Music impresario, Bill Coleman. From Billboard magazine editor to label owner, this DJ producer has worked with just about everybody in dance music, playing seminal roles in the careers of D-Light, Ultranate, and many others. Not to mention, he's also an occasional member of Jody Watley's touring band. Catch up with this legendary tastemaker as he plays a few songs from the soundtrack of his life. Only on The Sweet Spot, this Thursday, March 23rd at 10 p.m. WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio. 'Cause you're free.
On Saturday, March 25th and Sunday the 26th, come to a national conference for the full normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. Plenaries and workshops include voices from the U.S., Cuba, and Canada, developing joint strategies for ending the U.S. blockade and finishing the process towards normalization begun in 2014. And on Saturday night, a public program at the Shabazz Center in Harlem includes Puerto Rican hero Rafael Kinsel Miranda, Sandra Ramirez Rodriguez, director of the North American desk of Cuba's Friendship Institute, and founder of the Antonio Maceo Brigade, Andres Gomez. Music by Cuban jazz pianist Marcelo Casagrande and the Afro-Boricua drum and dance ensemble, Bombayo. That's March 25th through the 26th, a national conference for the full normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba at the Fordham University Law School, 62nd Street off Broadway in Manhattan. For registration and information, log on to www.nationalcubaconference.org.
Now, during the fun drive, you don't have to keep calling back because of busy signals or have to pull over to the side of the road or miss the show you were listening to in order to make your pledge.
Blah, 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 blah.
Now you can donate and choose your thank you gift online at your convenience at any time. Go to the new WBAI online donation site at www.givetowbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. You can also pledge in the name of your favorite show, choosing it from the drop-down menu, and whether you would like to be thanked on the air. Just go to www.give2wbai.org.
And in case you couldn't tell, you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI Broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Our guest this morning will be Sally Wiener-Rata, author, photographer, entrepreneur, cool person. Stay tuned. music from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, music by the wonderful Peter Schickele. No, not in his PDQ Bach persona, but rather in his Peter Schickele persona. So, Sally Grotta is our guest via Skype. Some of it is pre-recorded. We'll explain all that in a bit. But because it's Skype and because I never trust how this thing works, I am going to call her first and make sure that she is online. Ah, okay. Those are good noises. Hey there, Sally.
Hi there.
Ooh, ooh, it works. It works.
Wow. And I'm so impressed.
Yeah, and it really is so much better voice quality than phone, I gotta say. I'm not a big Skype fan, but you know, I've done God knows how many interviews on the phone and talked to you just moments ago on the phone, and the sound is clear. I like it. I like it.
Well, I'm glad you like it, since you're my expert on sound.
Uh-huh. Okay. I have good ears. I am not the expert on the technologies here at WBAI, and it was a long time. We had Skype for a long time, but it was that we could have a person on Skype talk to us on the air, but we couldn't talk to them.
What good is that?
What you could do, actually, is I could wear a headset like you're wearing, and at the same time that I'm wearing the headset, and you would hear me through the headset, I would still have to talk into a microphone. So, you know, two mics at the same time, basically, one for each purpose.
Yes.
And that is... dumb. But now I can use what passes for a mic. I'm actually using a guest mic. The normal host microphone seems to be in tatters, so I'm using the guest mic. It sounds better. And the headphones I normally use to be on the air, and lo, there you are.
Marvelous.
So
marvelous that technology sometimes works.
Sometimes, intermittently. Let me do announcements before we do our chat, talk, interview, whatever you may call it. But I really only have one major announcement to make, and it involves you.
Oh.
Well, you're the driver.
Okay.
You are literally driving the event that occurs on April 1st.
Yes, I am.
And that took a second, right? But in this very building, I'm on the third floor, but the New York Review of Science Fiction readings occur on the first floor at 388 Atlantic Avenue, usually the first Tuesday of every month, which in April would be April 4th. But we're going to fool people by going on April 1st. And we've done April 1st readings before, but we usually did them in order to justify having a comedy event. And this is not a comedy event. This is merely a joyful event, because April 1st is also the birthday of Samuel Ray Delaney, a.k.a. Chip. Only I can't say that nobody calls him Sam. Because one time when Chip was on Hour of the Wolf, we're talking now in the mid-70s, and the person following me was Jeff Greenfield, who has, you know, since has been a big mach on PBS and CBS, and he's got several political books out, and he worked on John Lindsay's campaign and all kinds of stuff. He's a political pundit, and his show followed mine. And I had Chip on the air. He came in like 5 minutes before, which is a good time to come in and start setting up. And he takes one look and he says, "Sammy! Sammy? Really?" Well, they were in the Bronx High School of Science together. And I'd never heard anybody call Samuel R. Delaney Sammy before or since.
Childhood names do carry us, carry through our lives, don't they?
I guess so. But it was a charming moment, actually. And it was very interesting because Delaney and Greenfield told me all about that class and the various people in that class. And there's whole bunches of people who were in that class, that particular graduating year at the Bronx High School of Science, and half of them are famous today, mostly for good reasons.
Fabulous.
So it is not. So April 1st is not only Chip Delaney's birthday, it's his 75th birthday. It's his diamond. I like saying, you know, rather than saying 75th, because that makes him sound old.
Which he certainly is not.
He is not. He is not. So rather I see this as the diamond birthday. Right? If a, you know, queen gets a diamond jubilee.
Well, it's appropriate. He has such a sparkling personality.
Ooh, absolutely. And so many facets to it.
Yes, no question about that.
Badumch. So I used to have a little electronic machine that has a rim shot. I mean, I still have it, but you should all be grateful that I left it at home. But anyway, April 1st, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. I think we're going to fill up. Judging from the reaction, I only started the publicity in earnest yesterday, and I'm getting, you know, lots of retweets and repostings on Facebook and people clicking, oh yeah, I'm coming, and even more people clicking, they're interested, and everybody should come here to 388 Atlantic Avenue to meet and greet one of the most important science fiction writers of any generation so far. I should say speculative fiction, because so much of what he writes is fantasy. I consider Dahlgren his masterwork science fiction, but I had Lester Del Rey on the air years ago screaming, this is not science fiction. This is crap like that Thomas Pynchon guy. Yeah, okay, I'll go along with that. Yeah, you know, it's crap like that Thomas Pynchon guy. The guy who wrote a book called Gravity's Rainbow, where the sun goes nova on the first page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of.
Also, his nonfiction, his critical work is fascinating.
The Motion on Light on Water, The Jewel Hinged Jaw. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this without benefit of bio in front of me because
right. There's
almost no need. But I will tell another often told anecdote, which is